I'm Jamie Seeker, and this is What It Takes. Each episode, I sit down with real business owners to talk about their journey, the wins, the challenges, and everything in between. Let's dive in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to What It Takes. Business owners tell all. Today, we're heading over to Austin, Texas, where innovation is alive and thriving. Our guest is Dr. Connor Glass, founder and CEO of Phantom Neuro, a neurotechnology company that's changing the way prosthetics connect to the human body. Now, Connor isn't just building breakthrough medical technology. He's leading a company that recently raised $19 million in Series A funding while navigating the incredibly complex world of process management, regulation, and strategy. And what I love about his story is that it started in medicine. He was a research fellow at Johns Hopkins, focusing on nerve injuries, and has grown into a business journey that's all about taking a world-changing idea from the lab bench to the marketplace. So today we'll dive into not just the tech, but the strategy. How do you manage processes in a field where every decision could impact lives, investors, and the future of medicine? So let's get into it with Dr. Connor Glass. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about your origin and even your pivot, because that's a pretty big piece to where you're at now. Before Phantom Neuro, you were on a medical research path. Can you just walk us through the moment that you realized you had to build a business and not just do research?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my life has been full of multiple pivots that have kind of landed me where I am today. And I've always been very open to following life wherever it takes me rather than being rigid about, the direction that I'm heading. And so, you know, I started off wanting to be in the military, doing ROTC in college, moved out of that to do pre-med and wanted to be a surgeon, went to medical school and wanted to be a plastic and reconstructive surgeon that basically connects humans and machines via implantable sensors. So that's what led me to Johns Hopkins to do a research fellowship in plastic and reconstructive surgery, focusing on kind of neuromuscular reconstructive surgery with the full intention of going on to residency. I was under the impression going into my research fellowship that all the technology in terms of the implantable sensors and the robotic systems and all of that was already figured out, because I had seen incredible demonstrations on YouTube and 60 Minutes and elsewhere of people with limb amputations or spinal cord injury or whatever it might be, wirelessly communicating with these machines in order to regain their functionality. But once I got into academia and kind of saw behind the curtain of academia, I recognized that some of those videos were quite misleading, and that what we were really seeing in those videos was proof of concept, and that that's very different from the actual commercial realization of what we're seeing in the lab, and that it takes an entirely different mindset to create a product versus whatever it takes to create an academic proof of concept success. And so then had the aha moment that really the technology did not at all exist, and that I was going to be waiting around for somebody else to create technology, and decided that I could have the greatest impact, at least I believed, by creating technology that could scale and impact, you know, everybody, rather than waiting on somebody else to create that and becoming a surgeon and hoping that it came into existence. And so I decided to do a full career pivot and start a company based on an idea that me and my collaborators had within the lab.
That's really cool. And we need people like you to be able to kind of see a need and kind of change and uproot your entire path and just go that direction. That's really cool.
For sure. I think a lot of people don't realize how much amazing innovation kind of just sits on the shelf within academia, because much of it is generated by people that are tenured professors or surgeons or, you know, students that are going on to their next PhD or postdoc. And so it's left kind of the die on the vine. And really, I wish there were more people that were willing to take the risk in order to start a company. It's incredibly hard. So I understand why people don't, but we need more people that are willing to take that leap of faith.
So how did you do it then? How did you translate your years of investment and lab research into a business model that investors now and partners fully believe in and are backing you?
Yeah. I hope they fully believe in me.
They put their money toward it.
They certainly did. So I had no experience creating a company or really in business at all when I first started. And I'm a solo founder, which is something maybe we can talk about that's quite challenging. And so, you know, I had this idea, and we submitted for a patent at Johns Hopkins that I was the primary inventor on. So I had this patent that I could license out into a company. But I was fortunate enough to have really two individuals around me that also started companies. So my older brother started a zero carb bread company. And then my best friend started a 3D printed rocket company. And so they were at totally different stages, but I was able to kind of leverage them and understand their journey and get a little bit of insight into how you even incorporate a company, how you give yourself your initial equity, you know, and establish an equity pool for future employees that don't exist at the time, and all of these different things. And so I was able to really lean on them to help me with the, you know, what's the right next step or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, it's just sheer grit and trial and error and waiting for something good to happen and getting a whole lot of no's before you get a single yes.
Oh, I love that you said that. And we need to get connected with your circle of friends there, your brother and your, because they sound like, I mean, those are two totally different directions and fields, but also same concept of, hey, this is the foundation that you need for business, regardless of what your idea is. So I really like that you said that. I want to talk a little bit about your process versus passion, because it sounds like you found something that you believed in. You were obviously passionate about, you were going to have your whole life's work toward it already, but then it doesn't always translate into a successful business. You had a great foundation in your circle of influence and were able to get that. But neurotech is complex. It's not like, you know, you can get anybody to just understand what it is that you're doing. How do you keep that excitement high while making sure that your team or your partners or whoever's backing you follows that structured process that it needs for regulatory approval, commercialization that you talked about? Those are things that I think, especially when you're working with investors, they have a very specific way that they want their money utilized sometimes. Sometimes you have silent partners, which is nice, but sometimes you have people that are very involved and want things done a certain way. And you have a very specific, I think, you know, technology that probably isn't always going to align with the way people want things to be done.
Certainly not. So neurotechnology is really challenging in the sense that it's not very relatable, right? So my brother, for example, has zero carb bread that tastes, you know, better than regular bread. You can give someone a slice of bread or say, hey, wouldn't you like it if bread had no carbs, right? And everybody can relate to that. Whereas when I say, hey, you know, we've got this minimally invasive prosthesis control system that talks to the electrical signals coming from your muscle and uses artificial intelligence, blah, blah, blah. You know, nobody knows what the hell I'm talking about. And so it was really challenging to turn. And mind you, I was in the middle of like a research fellowship where I was in the weeds of this stuff in all these deeply scientific ways. And I remember one time in particular, you know, I got an interview for YC, Y Combinator, and I went into the details of like the science behind nerves and muscles and all of this. I just saw all their eyes glaze over. I was like, oh gosh, yeah, this is not happening. I totally blew this. And I had like an aha moment then that was like, man, you really got to move away from the science and turn this into something that's super relatable to people, which is really hard to do for what we're doing. And then also found, you know, that we're starting with upper limb amputation, and upper limb amputation is not a massive market, and it's something that's kind of been pretty stagnant for a very long time, and it's not necessarily a sexy market like artificial intelligence or defense or something like that today. And so I had to find a way to really express the grand vision of where we want to go with this technology well beyond prosthetics. And I think that's how we've been successful in raising, you know, close to $30 million at this point, is really focusing on the larger mission and saying that we have to start somewhere. Everyone has to start somewhere, right, with a business. And we've chosen to start with upper limb amputation for various reasons. But talking about kind of the broad promise of human-machine integration and having these universal controllers that can allow people with disabilities and otherwise to connect up to machines, that it really creates an entirely different world. And so in terms of talking about like process and how to keep everybody aligned, I make sure that everyone we hire has really bought into the grand vision in the direction that we want to head and use that as our North Star for every decision that we make. I wish that the startup world and process was like a super organized, well thought out type of thing. You know, I was used to like in medicine where X amount of effort results in Y positive result, right? The startup journey is not that at all. It's very circuitous. It is not directly related to the amount of effort that you put in. It's more serendipity than it is anything else, and just simply staying alive. And so that lends itself to a lack of a process and a willingness to pivot and just make decisions with very little information. So I think one thing that I'm very good at is making decisions and moving forward with very little information and with a lot of risk. And so when you're talking about venture capital and getting those people aligned with the direction you're heading, we've made sure, to the best of our abilities, to choose our investors, the people investing in us really believe and buy into the grand vision of this, you know, minimally invasive human machine interface that goes well beyond prosthetic limbs and all of that. And so their goal is for us to push the boundaries, move fast, break things, and really shoot for the stars, because to them, somewhat small exit on the order of 100 million, you know, a relatively small exit on the order of $100 million is not what they're going for. They're going for the full, you know, unicorn dream. And that means that they also are very amenable to risk and all of that. And so they really put a lot of faith in me in making the decisions as a solo founder. And I look up to them to give me guidance when I need it and direction. But they're very supportive, and it's been nothing but a positive experience, I would say, thus far.
So something that you would say is your process would be in choosing people that align with your vision and the direction that you're going, which is a major. I was going to ask, what early processes did you put in place at Phantom Neuro that you're most grateful for now that the company's grown? And obviously, I was thinking of operationally, but I think that's a really huge one to start with.
To me, I think you can get lost in the sauce of operational processes too early on, and that can be very detrimental. And so in my experience, being very open to a lack of a process and constantly pivoting is more important than saying, I have these processes and I'm going to stick to them no matter what. And so definitely, like, if there is a process that I've had, surrounding myself and hiring people that buy into this grand vision is priority number one. Number two is surrounding myself with amazing friends and key opinion leaders and people that I trust and look up to. That was probably the very first thing that I did, was by going out to people like my brother and my friend and other individuals from academia and the military and elsewhere, in order to get advice and lend credence to my name that really had no real value to it except for my medical degree and the research that I was doing. It was really bringing on these really amazing people as advisors or via other applications to help give credence to what we were doing and validity.
Yeah. And that's really good. Done is better than perfect in the beginning. And really, obviously there's something to getting efficient and putting, you know, stringent things in place, you know, once you're there. But in the beginning, when you're just trying to get things done, getting them done is more important than making sure that everything is all in a row. And I think that that leads to the chaos. So all of the things that you talked about it takes in the beginning, I think that's probably part of the reason why, but it's also an environment that helps you to thrive as well and get there quickly, like you said, and fail forward and make some of those mistakes. And like you said, you were okay having people on board that they were like, oh yeah, just break things, but get there, right? And learn from it and go. And I think that's really big. So you've also partnered with organizations like Ottobock and Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, where, you know, you started. What's your strategy for identifying, securing the right partners? Because that's something that you said you did early on. You sought out people who aligned with your vision, and that's obviously, you know, you're still here and looking back and thriving in it. So I think strategic partnerships is another key success factor that I think people need to consider.
For sure. So first and foremost, interpersonal relationships are everything. And so I think that people have to buy into you as a person almost more than they buy into the company that you're creating. And so with all of these relationships, it can be very scary getting into bed with very large corporations. So like Johns Hopkins as an entity is massive, right? And I was nothing. Ottobock, you know, in this world of limb difference, they're the largest player. You know, they're a multi-billion-dollar German corporation. And so making sure that we had really good interpersonal relationships ahead of, or as quickly as we could, you know, ahead of actually inking agreements between the two parties was extremely important. But having those entities on board, once again, adds to the credibility of the institution that you're trying to create as a founder. And I think that that's one of the biggest value adds early on is the people that you surround yourself with, because especially like in the medical world, right? It takes a very long time to develop an implantable medical device. And so, you know, you have proof points along the way, but really a lot of the value of the company are the people that you hire, the institutions that you bring on as a part of this, and kind of how people perceive you as a founder. And so I've worked really hard to try to foster those types of relationships, including with like contractors, for example. You know, so we do not manufacture like our implant in-house because it's extremely expensive to build out the infrastructure and clean rooms and all of these certifications to do so. And so we partner with people or big organizations outside of our company in order to do that on our behalf. And so making sure that you have really good interpersonal relationships with those people ensures that, you know, you're not going to get charged, you know, an exorbitant amount of money that's unrealistic. It'll ensure that everybody's aligned and focused on the mission and seeing you succeed rather than everybody fighting for an extra dollar, which can certainly be the case in the United States. So,
yeah, that's really great. And I think that when you're in such a cutting edge field, there is a time and a place to choose who you surround yourself with, but also like, you know, you want it to be people that are, like you said, they are into that. They have those certifications. That's what they specialize in. So the theme that we keep coming back to is that lesson that your parents teach you when you're growing up is like, you know, who are you surrounding yourself with? Like, oh, so-and-so is in the wrong crowd. Like, oh, it's never the bad kid. It's like, oh, they got running in with the wrong crowd. But it also, I think when you're showing, you're talking about strategically positioning your company, you've talked about the people that you're bringing in, you're talking about your vendors, you're talking about people who are investing in you, all of that is, I think, you know, just goes back to that key lesson that mom and dad tried to teach you when you were a kid. And I think that's really cool in business too.
Yeah. You know, I've never really thought about it that way, but I've always been a very strong believer that you are who you surround yourself with.
Absolutely.
And you are just an amalgamation of their personalities and habits and the things that they do. And I've definitely abided by that in forming this company and trying to surround myself with really good humans as best as I'm able to.
Yeah, that's great. And then I also wanted to talk about something else you said about risk takers and, you know, that's also kind of who you're surrounding yourself with and people who understand what the goal is so that they're more willing to do that. But how do you decide when, because this is also what you're doing, I think is it's also very important to get it right. And so what I know is that the reason why we have process and the reason why we try to standardize things and all of that is to eliminate inefficiencies and mistakes and things like that. So how do you decide when to stick to that process and when it's time to like pivot and take the risk now that you're out of that like crazy beginning, you know, chaotic stage?
Yeah. So we obviously don't cut corners or take risks when there are governing bodies that have established, you know, guidelines that we have to follow.
Yeah, obviously, that's key. That's, yeah, we're not talking about that, everybody.
Right. So whatever the FDA says goes. Now, that's not to say that you have to just, you know, take somebody else's story that they or experience they had with the FDA and consider that Bible and that you have to follow it word by word and all of that. You can interact with the FDA and challenge assumptions and have open conversations and try to create as good of a situation as possible for yourself in terms of like clinical trial design. And you have to remember at the end of the day, on the other side of all of these organizations are other humans. And so once again, by treating them as humans and by building interpersonal relationships, you can have open conversations about, you know, clinical trial designs, for example, because the reality is that the FDA can ask for certain things for a clinical trial. And that might be a death sentence for you as a company. For example, if the FDA requires that you have, let's say, like a 5-year trial to follow patients longitudinally before they'll take the data and, you know, utilize that for whatever purpose, that can be a death sentence for a company, right? Because that means that I have to have money to operate this clinical trial and support all my staff and all of this stuff for 5 years for this one clinical trial before I've even hit the market and can start selling anything, which is one of the challenges with like medical devices and pharma and everything, is that you have to stay afloat almost entirely off VC dollars for years, and it's very expensive. So you know, we were fortunate enough to get breakthrough designation and into this TAP program, they call it, where we get to interact with the FDA a little bit more freely and frequently. And so I've never hesitated to ask questions to the FDA that other people might hesitate to ask because they think there's some proper, you know, requirements on how you communicate with these other humans. Whereas in reality, you can ask them whatever the heck you want to, and they can refuse to answer something or say, you know, that's not necessarily appropriate. Haven't had that response, but you know, you can say whatever you want. And so you can really, you know, try to make the process something that's aligned with your company. And so where I was going with that 5-year story is, you know, if you tell the regulators, hey, that's going to be a death sentence. You can tell me that that's my requirement, but like, I'm going to die as a company. And so this is a moot point if that's where we're going to end up. And then you can have an open conversation about, okay, well, does this make sense or this or that? And so then you can come to something that's agreeable that balances both kind of the regulatory necessities with the desire to actually get the technology out into the market and not die as a company ahead of time, because that's not in the best interest of anybody. So wherever there's red tape and process, I try to optimize that process to the benefit of the company and the optimization of, you know, dollars in and dollars out. And then outside of that, I really take opportunities whenever they're presented and am totally open to other people's opinions. I trust in my staff. And if they tell me that something needs to happen and we need to hire this new person and we need to spend this money on something else, I really listen to them and try to abide by what they say, assuming that it makes sense. And so just constantly pivoting and thriving in the chaos.
Yeah. Well, I really like that. It's like a people first mentality. Like the process is supposed to support what you're doing, not the other way around. And I do find that, and I think that's kind of true in life. Like, not to say that I don't follow the law or anything, like I'm absolutely a law-abiding citizen and things like that. But normally, like when you look at a guideline, regulation, law, things like that, you're like, well, what's the heart of it? Like, what was it they're intending to do? I understand what you're saying in black and white. It says, don't do this, but why is it saying that? Right. And so I think that's really what you're saying is you're not challenging the regulatory, you know, everything that they're putting in place. It's more of like, okay, great, but does that make sense in this situation? And let's talk person to person and put the people first. Like there are people behind them, you know, that sure. governing body and they're actual, you know, they can think and they can problem solve with you. And if you look at more of like a collaboration and how do we get to this end point, that works not only internally within your own company, with your own investors, with your own vendors, it works that way with people who are really actually the governing, the FDA is there for our protection as consumers, for your protection as a company, when you're really looking at like, hey, these are things that we've learned over the years that they're guidelines for you to help you in, you know, creating whatever it is that you're trying to put to market. So I think that's really good. It just kind of follows that theme and that philosophy that you have when it comes to people and putting people first, and even your processes are there to support that. And you know, I've had conversations like within the last week or two about how you could be doing something that like seems right, but it's wrong because you look at like the heart of it and it's like, that's not really okay. You're technically right. But like, you know, and vice versa, like yesterday it was wrong, but like the intention is different. And so although it's like wrong in black and white, it was probably the right thing to do. Right. And so if you're thinking about taking all of that red tape, like you said, out of there, I think, you know, you get to that. So that brings me to my last and final question that I ask everyone. What's your take on, you know, what does it take to be a business owner? You know, we're telling all here, and you kind of pulled the curtain back a little bit about how you make decisions and whatnot. Anything you didn't say or more that you want to expand on in this, you know, what it takes?
Yeah, I mean, what it takes is just a relentless belief in whatever it is that you're doing, a literal desire to like rather die than not succeed at whatever it is that you're doing. And the understanding that there are no sure things in this game. There are no real like patterns. There's no playbook. It's all about staying alive long enough for something good to happen. And you have to be comfortable in really uncomfortable situations when you're just trying to survive to stay alive long enough. And someone once said to me, actually that friend that has the rocket company, he said, in order to survive, you have to sprint faster towards death. And that is really the heart of a startup environment. So when you're running out of money and your investors are telling you, well, you should think about cutting this and cutting that and extending your runway and whatever it is, you have to decide, at least I have in the moment, and all of my employees, that nobody signed on to this startup game to like just get a probably average paycheck, you know, compared to what they could get at Meta or something like that, and just stay alive as long as possible. We're all in this to like change the world ideally and to make really big things happen. And so we'd rather see the company go up in flames actually than just kind of skirt into a really prolonged and ugly death. And so instead of like cutting budgets and things in order to extend your runway, you actually need to spend more money at that time to generate more progress and more PR hype and more all the different things that are going to help you raise money. And so to me, that's the secret to this, is not dying and being willing to lean into things when they get really, really hard. So the harder it gets, the more you need to lean into it.
That's great. That's great advice. Connor, thank you so much for sharing not the science, but the strategy behind Phantom Neuro. And it's really inspiring to hear how you've managed to balance that medical innovation side with building a company that has like a very clear path forward. And I think your vision is what's taking it there. So if you want to get a hold of Connor or learn more about Phantom Neuro, how can listeners find you?
Yeah, please. So you can go on our website, www.phantomneuro.com, or you can reach out to us at info@phantomneuro.com. Lots of exciting things going on. So we'd love to hear from people that are interested in the technology, people that think that they could benefit from the technology, collaborators, all sorts of fun things.
Yeah. And if you love this episode and this conversation that we had, make sure that you subscribe, share it with a friend, keep tuning in as we bring you more behind the scenes stories of entrepreneurs like Connor who are building not just companies, but legacies. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Seeker Solution. Are you a business owner feeling overwhelmed? We can help. Head over to SeekerSolution.com to schedule a call today. Would you or someone you know like to be featured on this podcast? Our applications are now open. Apply today at SeekerSolution.com and click on the podcast link to get started.